Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. Let me turn to probably the biggest issue that we haven't tackled. It's very common for the children to become footballs in the oppositional game that happens when there's a believer and a disbeliever. From the disbeliever's perspective, it's like, I'm not going to subject my children to that guilt. I'm not going to subject my children to the lies and the deception. I'm not going to subject them to patriarchy. I'm not going to subject my girls to, you know, the way that the girls are devalued. I don't want my son serving a mission. Husband or believer, you go do what you want, but I'm not going to stand for my kids to be, you know, for the lie to be perpetrated through them. You know, that's the disbeliever's perspective. The believer's perspective is, look, you want to go screw up your life. Our kids are going to be faithful. They're going to, you know, go to seminary. They're going to go on missions. They're going to get married in the temple. And, you know, this is good for them. This is wholesome for them. This is going to make them happy. And go mess up your own life. But I'm bringing the kids with me. And there's no negotiation about that. Did you guys ever then, or do you ever now, sympathize with either of those poles? And how do you keep the kids from becoming footballs in a very violent, you know, contact sport, so to speak?
it can happen really easily, and I sympathize with both of those poles. Both of them, I can see it from both sides. I don't want to be outside of my own child's temple wedding like a kid, you know. But what we both figured out is that we have to surrender. We have to surrender our own ideals of what the kids are and give them the best chance that they have at being happy. And one of the best chances they have at being happy is to see a model of two people so different who love each other and support each other no matter what. And that they can have that same freedom that we will love them no matter what they choose, no matter what. And we'll teach them, you know, I think as the non-believer, if my spouse were to say, and this would be a deal breaker for me possibly, if Dan were to say, I'm teaching them only about church, I don't want you teaching them that crazy yoga stuff, they have to go on missions, this and that. That's not okay for me. These are my kids. That affects my relationship with my children, my ability to be honest with them. And that's not something I'm willing to negotiate on. But at the same point, I'm not going to take that away from Dan. He needs that just as well. And so we've come to this point with the kids. I'll let Dan talk because I've talked a little bit. But where we try to answer it in both paradigms. So if the kids ask us about God, I'll say, well, the Mormons believe this, or I think Dad believes this. And then I'll say, and people believe all sorts of things. I believe this. And then I'll say, what do you think? So they have this really clear idea. Hopefully I've helped them with my beliefs. Maybe they're finding a connection with that. But they have the freedom to choose. And how empowering is that for them to be able to choose?
Well, that's one perspective, how empowering. There's another perspective, which is how confusing. It's like, you know, come on, these kids, their brains aren't fully developed yet. Literally, they're being confronted and bombarded in this, you know, worldly sphere with pornography and drugs and sex and alcohol and violence. The last thing they need is sort of this, well, Mom believes this and Dad believes that and other people believe the other and you guys believe whatever you want to. Like, you know, even Dr. Laura, not that she's the highest authority to invoke, but there's lots of people who just say, forget what's true, forget what's literal, pick a belief system, a single belief system be kind enough, be charitable enough to give them a single, consistent, clear belief system. And then, yeah, when they're 30 or when they're 25 even, yeah, then they can start experimenting once they've sort of made it through the minefield that is adolescence and early adulthood. But don't do them this disservice of this, Unitarian, universalistic upbringing, because by not giving them something clear, you're really giving them nothing. You think you're giving them everything. You really think you're giving them everything, but really you're giving them nothing.
Well, there's two points to that. And the first one is that you have to be unified in your parenting. We have to have really clear agreements between the two of us of what's okay, right? It's not okay for our children, our teenager, to go out drinking. It's not okay for him to get a D or an F. It's not okay for him to sass us back. It's not okay for them to be mean to other kids. You know, we encourage these things. I expect them to go to church with Dan. You know, that's something I support, and that's a given. But the other side of that, too, is that I think people who say you have to teach your kids this regimented viewpoint, it's better that they believe something than a bunch of mumbo-jumbo. You cannot treat your children like idiots. They're not idiots. They start learning spirituality from the time they are tiny. They're tiny, and they have emotions, and they have feelings. And those children, I think, feel that they get closer to the divine than we do. And we can learn a lot from them. So don't discredit their ability to know God. Because I think truly what happens to us as we give them, you know, this is the belief and there are three tiers of heaven and there's this and that, we actually unenlighten them. They come enlightened and we create a framework around that, you know, that is a disservice sometimes. Can we open them up that Mormonism is a very valid path? It's really valid. I support your dad on that. You want to go on a mission, I support you on that. But we are all, both Dan and I are in agreement that they read some, that they know the true church history and they know all the problematic things so that they can make an educated choice. Our teenager is able to do that. Our 10-year-old is really starting to understand nuance now. I don't think we should discredit the children.
Right, right. Dan, how about you?
Yeah, the thing is that, you know, Laurie and I have a unified belief system in terms of the belief, in terms of the values that we have. You know, what might be different is the story in which we relate to those values.
Right.
This really occurred to me. One of my breaking moments when we were figuring in the counseling process is that one night I remember us talking about kind of, we went back to some of the basics about what we believe in God and the meaning of life. And it really hit me that Laurie and I weren't that far apart in what we believed. What we had is we're different people who needed a different language to relate to it. Hmm. You know, but in terms of what our core values were, in terms of what we valued the most, it wasn't that different, and it wasn't that different through all this crap that we had been through and arguing and fighting about religion was that at the core of it, we weren't that different of people in terms of what was important to us and what was important to us for the kids. You know, honesty, integrity, accountability, kindness, love, these have been our values since the day we got married, and they're our values today. You know, that part of the contract was never shredded. You know, it's getting new language wrapped around it, maybe, but it's there.
Right.
And you can have that as a core belief system. I don't think all the window dressing that we put around our belief systems with religious theologies, you know, I don't think that's a recipe for family disaster if parents disagree on that window dressing. You know, I grew up in this family where I had a Mormon mother and a non-member, non-church-going, smoking, drinking, coffee-sucking father, who were both really good people, and who both had, who instilled those values in me and in our family, that you're honest, that you act with integrity. I want my family to have the benefit I had, in that my parents never, even after my dad converted and became a really strong, true-believing Mormon, and he is today, I never had the pressure put on me by them that I had to believe a certain way. And I'm so grateful for that, because I didn't feel like I had to go out on a mission. I chose to go. I knew they wanted me to go. I knew they'd be sad if I didn't, but I never feared that I'd be ostracized or, okay, you're forever a disappointment to me now. I knew I'd be loved and accepted, but I just chose to go. And I was able to choose how I viewed the church, how I took in these things. I was able to have that space for that. And I'm going to provide that for my kids. I'd like them to have the Mormon experience I had and see if they can take the good things that I was able to take. You know, but if they get to the end of their, youth, to their adult lives and, decide, okay, the church is okay, but doesn't work for me going forward, I'm not going to be upset or angry about that. I'm going to say, okay, I gave that a shot, and they have to follow their own path. And to be honest, we have three kids, and they're three very different kids. I could really see all three of our kids taking some different paths, because that's what's happened in my own family. I've got two siblings, and my brother left the church when he left home at 18 and has never looked back. My sister is an extremely devout, active, in everything believer. I fall somewhere in between them somehow, but we've taken our own paths, but we're a family, and we're together. I'm not gonna, that system worked for me growing up. I didn't grow up to be a mess of a person. I don't see any reason to break from that for my own family. And I'm lucky in the fact that Laurie has these very strong values, that I don't see a need to panic because they're not voiced in the common Mormon language. But they're there. They're very much there. And we don't really have a lot of disagreements. We don't, she's supportive. Our oldest attends seminary now. And she was very much supportive of that. I didn't have to convince her that, cause she felt that, he needs to understand, the kids need to understand their religion that they're being raised with, especially if they're going to get to a point where they have to decide if they're going to go forward with it or not. And on a mission, I saw so many missionaries that didn't want to be out there. I've never at one point in my life felt to force my kids on a mission. I will not do that. They have to make the choice.
But Dad makes those decisions easy, like the seminary decision, because he doesn't put an extra expectation on our son. We want him to go and learn, and we leave it open-ended for him to have his own experience. And that's all I want. We want our kids to be happy. It's pretty arrogant of us to say we know the way to be happy, and you need to do what we're doing.
But, Laurie, I know I've already asked this, but the common reaction to the disbeliever is, I have to pull my kids out of the cult. I mean, it's that severe. And I know that may sound shocking to some of my audience, but that is the reaction. It's like Jim Jones in Guyana Town has my children.
The thing is,
how you feel, the sympathies you feel towards gay people, the feminist in you, how do you keep from feeling like the church is going to do violence to your children?
Because my spouse is supporting me when I tell them that it's wrong. So when I teach my kids that we talk about gay marriage, what was it? Oh, my daughter's 5, and she asked me, just out of the blue, what is gay, Mom? What does gay mean? She'd heard it somewhere. And I said, oh, it's when instead of having a boyfriend or a girlfriend, you have a boyfriend and a boyfriend, or a girlfriend and a girlfriend, or a woman wants to marry a woman, and families are made of different things. And she goes, okay. Now, if my spouse didn't let me explain it that way and had a problem with me talking about it that way, then I would probably feel like it is a cult and my kids were going to get brainwashed. I would feel like if I didn't have the freedom to talk openly, then I would worry that they were being indoctrinated and not. But if both spouses are pretty open-minded about that, it's not such a feeling. Now, when it does feel painful is when I think about like not being at my kid's wedding or those things. I also feel, though, that the kids are going to, they're either going to believe you because you're living it and they're going to see that it works, or they're going to see that it's a divisive issue. So the fact that we figured out how to talk to the kids about this and that Dan is open-minded enough to let me share with them what I believe is why it works, and vice versa. You know, he can teach them about the gospel, and I'm not going to come in later in the evening and say, that stuff Dad taught you, it's not really true, you know? So that's the key, I think, is to really respect each other and allow each other the idea to open them up. And not everybody's okay with that.
Right.
I'll add one thing here, though, too, for the, you know, I can appreciate some concerns of a non-believer because so much in the church is, you know, the church is not a universal experience from one community and city and town and ward to the other. You know, so much depends on the kind of people you're around.
Yeah.
I had this epiphany when I was at BYU, and here I was pretty newly off a mission and, you know, consider myself a traditional believer in that. And it hit me that I said, if I stay in Utah, I'm not going to want to stay involved with the church, you know. I had that epiphany one day. It was really weird because – and that sounds really bad. I'm not trying to put down Utah and put down people there and offend people. It was – you know, there was something about having the Mormon culture be so strong and pervasive that I knew would make me push away from it. So I've ended up in the kind of communities that work for me in that. But I understand that if, you know, depending on the war, so much in the church depends on the kind of people you're around. And we've had the good fortune, we've got incredible good fortune now that we're around really good, sharp, intelligent, fair-minded people. Our ward is full of wonderful people. They're, you know, and they're a lot of them are traditional believers. We'll, you know, we'll disagree on certain things, like gay marriage and that. But, you know, they're good people who are well-intentioned, trying to do the good things, not a cult at all. But if you were in a – I can understand if you were in a ward or a situation where, you know, things were more harsh and extreme, people were more harsh and extreme, and you just didn't feel that, you know, that sort of positive vibe there. I can understand there being a greater concern for having kids involved in it. I think you have to approach – you know, what we're adding here is not a blanket prescription for every situation everybody's in. Because I've heard situations from people where I think, yeah, maybe if I were in that situation, I'd limit the involvement with that bishop, that person. So, you know, what we're seeing here is we're lucky in the fact that we have a really good situation. I think most wards in the church and most people I've experienced in the church are good people, are intentioned. I don't think it tries to people. The cult thing doesn't work for me at all, but, you know, you have to deal with your situation that's on the ground where you're at.
It is really individual from ward to ward, but ultimately you have to be able to tune out everybody else. And pay attention to what your kids are learning and how they're growing. And it might be perfectly appropriate for a specific child to limit their indoctrination if they had a wild and crazy teacher or something.
Right,
you have to. You know, my mom says monitor and adjust. Right. Keep watching. Keep paying attention. It's going to change. It's constantly going to shift and change.
Right.
How we relate. As long as we can put each other first and keep love at the center of it and have everybody's best intentions and remember that we're a team and we're all doing this together. And if we can do it happily, all the more the better, right?
Right. So it occurs to me that, as we've talked today, a huge secret to how you guys have been able to make it work is that you've met in the middle, that you've understood each other's perspective, you have sincere empathy for the other's point of view, and you're willing to both give to accommodate, to meet in the middle, and to show respect for the other person's position. And I think that's crucial. Dan, I'm going to ask you a hard question. I kind of tried to ask Lori a couple hard ones. There's a hard one I have for you. And okay. it's not for you per se. It's more for the scenario that some people in your shoes are in a little bit of a different place than you. You acknowledged from the start that you weren't wrapped in a literalistic, orthodox, hardcore Mormon mindset in your youth. And you felt good things for the church, but there's a lot of stuff you just kind of blew off or didn't worry about. Most of the believers that I encounter that are in your shoes are not like you. They are fused with the idea of the prophet speaks for God. They're fused with the idea that if the prophet says it, it's true. They're fused with the idea that they have to have a righteous priesthood holder in the home, when it's the woman. And they're fused with the idea that their kids are going to have a righteous priesthood holder father. They're fused with the idea of the celestial kingdom and eternal increase and whatever else they're fused with. And it's not just like this, oh, well, there's good in the church and I'm going to give my spouse the benefit of the doubt. It's more like, this is the one true church. This is the way. This is the way it has to be. My parents are stake presidents and mission presidents. Like, there is no middle ground here. You're either all in or you're all out. And so for the ones that are more practical, they might resonate with your story. But what can we do for the people who are completely fused with an orthodox, literalistic mindset? Do you have any idea how a marriage can reach an accommodation? I mean, do you have to loosen the beliefs of the believer? Do you have to turn them into stage 5 Fowler Mormons and de-literalize? Or can you see any hope for a marriage when the believer is orthodox?
I see hope because I believe, am I quoting Beatles here? I believe in the power of love. That's Huey Lewis. sorry, that's terrible. Okay, to be serious, yeah, I understand the difficulty because, I was hesitant to do this with you at first because I thought, how many believers out there are going to relate to my story? The reason I thought I had some views to add is because even where I was, the difficulty I went through at first dealing with this, tells me that it's really hard, and I can appreciate that. I'm not totally familiar with all the details of the Fowler stages, but what I do think is that I think if you have a basis of true love for each other, I think there is always a possibility to get it worked out because that is such a powerful, powerful thing. But you have to look at what do you really love about your spouse? Did you really, especially when you get to this point of a faith crisis where, like I said, it seems to be in a lot of cases, you've been married years and you have kids and you've been through experiences. So when you look back at all of that, is everything that you value in your spouse based on the church or their belief in the church or what you thought their belief was? Are there things that you – or have you truly learned to love that person that in the ways that have nothing to do with the church, the ways that they're an individual and what they bring to the relationship? I think you have to start at that point. And if you're – I suppose theoretically if you've only been married because you wanted to marry another Mormon and go through this and you've gone through these years and you don't have that love, yeah, maybe – maybe that's just going to be too hard. But I think if you have that to start with, that's what you have to build on. And you have to kind of dissect in an honest way how much of the reason you love your spouse is related to the church or anything to do with the church. Start with that, because I really think that as most people will look at it, they'll find the things that they loved about their spouse that didn't have anything to do with it. And that's a starting point. And it doesn't, you don't have to give up your own beliefs or testimony to get to that. You just have to be honest and say, you know, I love these things about her or him, you know, and they're not tied to Mormonism. You know, the other part is, you know, look at yourself. And, you know, what I did have to look and say, what did I really believe? You know, because I think what happens is in the shock and panic of these situations, we kind of fall back to the training and the conditioning. And the Mormon Church is very powerful at conditioning. You know, even I felt it in my kind of loose relationship with it. When this happened, I had that conditioning reared up inside. You have to get past that shock a little bit and examine yourself. What do you really believe? Do you really believe that what God wants is for you to break up your family and have your children lose a parent or end up in a shared custody because of this? Do you think that's the best thing eternally? You know, what do you really believe? You know, you have to, in fairness, be able to look at that, because you have to appreciate, one thing I've gained is that I told you early on that I had kind of a prejudice for a while about the kind of typical disaffected believer that I saw. And it wasn't fair for me to even have that opinion then, because I had known a lot of people who had lost their belief even up to that point. But, as I've gotten to know more people, you know, there's wonderful people out there that lose their faith, not because of something wrong they were doing. You know, when I honestly looked at what happened with Laurie, you know, she was becoming this happier person. What did I really have to complain about?
Right.
And you have to, maybe you don't want to read all the same books and you're fearful about losing everything, but in fairness, you should be willing to examine your beliefs. Because if any belief that you have that can't be at least self-examined by you, stand up to some inner scrutiny, maybe that's not worth having, or maybe that's not worth holding on to so dearly that you lose what you've built with your family. So maybe there are things that are worth reexamining. And listen to your spouse and understand what's gone on with them. But I think the most important thing to start with is the love that you have for that spouse. You know, how much of that love is really tied to the LDS story? How much is not? Be honest and try to build from there. I think it can be done, and I think it can be done without, you know, I don't think you have to lose a testimony to make it work. But I do think that, you know, just when a spouse loses their own testimony, they've gone through some struggles too. And, you know, they probably started, I mean, I remember you hearing your story on your podcast, John, and you didn't, you know, you were trying to do your job as a seminary teacher, when right. you came across all this information. And, you know, how could you not, if I don't know how your wife reacted, but, you know, if I were in her,
she
you
cried.
Know, if I were in her shoe, yeah. But, you know, when you, after you listen to it for a while and understand it, how can you not at least honor, you know, your spouse, you know, trying to do something well, and, you know, things came up, and, you know, you have to be able to at least, you know, gain an appreciation for what your spouse has gone through. You can be sympathetic to the point that it's not an easy thing they've gone through to get there. It doesn't mean you have to do the same, make the same path or come to the same choices, but you can empathize. The core thing, though, is I think maybe start at the beginning and try to understand each other. What did you really, what really ties you guys to the church, individually? What do you really believe? And go from there. I think it can work. Maybe I'm optimistic, but.
Yeah. And I want to agree with something you said. It's so easy for the believing spouse to look at the disbelieving spouse as weak and faithless and betraying and dishonest. And again, sometimes they do a little bit to foster that belief if they get too angry or if they start not spending their capital wisely. And as we talked about earlier, asking for too much too soon in terms of accommodations on the disbeliever part. But I encourage believing spouses to view their disbelieving spouses in the way that I've experienced the most. And again, I've counseled with 500 to 1,000 disbelieving people now, and it's almost never that they were looking to sin. It's almost never that they were weak or didn't care. It is almost always that they were seeking truth. They were following their heart. They were listening to the Spirit. They were seeking honor and integrity at all cost. It's one of the most courageous things you can possibly do to say, I'm willing to let go of my security. I'm willing to let go of my worldview. I'm willing to risk alienation from my spouse. I'm willing to risk losing my children. I'm willing to risk alienation from my family and friends because truth matters to me that much. And integrity and love and feeling good matters to me that much. And so I would challenge believing spouses, as hard as it may be, to try and view their disbelieving spouses from a standpoint of integrity and honor and respect, even though it seems impossible to do that. I think everyone's going to win if you take on that perspective, if it's realistic. So just supporting you there, Dan.
Thanks.
Laurie, I would love you to share real quick how you've chosen to talk to bishops and ward members. I think you have a really good perspective on how to break the news to the bishop, how to draw clear boundaries, how to talk to ward members. How do you make that transition with the ward members so that it's most healthy for everybody?
That one's still in process a bit, and it's been a challenge to figure that out. That's at the beginning, I thought maybe I should remove my name from the records of the church so that there's no more confusion. But then I didn't want to do that. So we went in and we talked to the bishop, and I told him where I was at with it, and I told him matter of factly that I'm here to explain to you that I don't want a calling. This is what I need. And I'm here to ask you to support my husband because he's going to be coming alone with the children. And I said, I don't want to be a project. I don't want people calling me or trying to reconvert me. And he's really honored that. He had some big questions for me. We talked for a little bit. But I try to see things through his viewpoint, that his intention is really to be loving and helpful. Same with everybody at church. They just want to help you be happier. And for the most part, I've had some friends within the church for a really long time who know me well and have kind of been through this process with me, and they love me no matter what. And they get it. A lot of them come to yoga with me now.
Cute.
In the newer ward, people don't know me as well. And I just have had to let it go. You just have to do what feels right to you at the moment. We're getting a few more questions about it. My visiting teachers would love to help. And it's hard to explain where you're at without, I don't want to insult anybody or their beliefs. And they don't necessarily understand. And I don't know that they will understand when I say, I don't believe. And I don't want to spill out my whole can of worms on somebody who's not ready to know about all the historical issues. So what I try and do is just live my life the way that feels right to me, regardless of what anybody thinks. And to do it as gracefully and as loving as I can. I love my friends at church. I'm still building those friendships in this new ward, and I love it. They're great people to be around. They have great values. They're fun and friendly, and their kids are great. And I still want to be connected with that. So I'm open to that. You know, great example was Sunday. Sunday I was off to go to the Bay Area to to see Adi Ashanti, and I need to wear comfortable pants to sit, hear this Sot song. So I'm in my jeans and my tank top, and I'm supposed to be taking my daughter after sacrament to meet Dan at church. And he texts me and he says that some of our friends from our old ward are here for a missionary homecoming. Mm. And I'm thinking, oh, I'd love to see them, but I'm in jeans and a tank top.
Right.
Well, I just walked into the lobby. That's how I am. I don't feel bad about it. Mm. I got hugs from friends. And yes, they look at me like, what's up? You know,
right.
I figure they can still ask. I took my daughter in. I hugged my friends from the old ward, you know, and that was that. They, you know, it's kind of up to them how they're going to deal with it. And I think it's a little bit confusing because I do show up like that as I am, really honestly. But I'm so friendly. I really honestly enjoy them. I don't know if they quite understand where I'm at. I'm sure that's going to grow over time. I would love to get to know people in this ward well enough to share with them where I'm at. But it's been good.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. That story is just hilarious because there's a part of me that is just aghast, imagining a woman walking into church on Sunday in a tank top and jeans. I mean, it's just the Mormon part of me, that's just appalling. It's like the Twilight Zone. And then I think about like Jesus, and I'm like, he wouldn't care at all, at all. He wouldn't bat an eye. He would love you more. And I'm like, that's a pretty big disparity.
Yeah,
he would have loved to have a tank top back where they lived. You know, that was pretty hot out there. Yeah.
Well, and then of course my visiting teacher asks, "Are you going to visit your sister today?" And I said, "Not really."
Well,
I've had people ask me at the ward party over the punch bowl, you know, how come I don't ever see you at church? And my answer is just, sometimes it's not my thing. You know, I mean, what are you going to say? I'm not getting into that discussion over the punch bowl. So people tend to sense your boundaries. If you know your boundaries and you're also committed to kindness, people can sense that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this has been great. I guess I want to end. Well, I'm going to end asking Dan one quick last question. And Dan, you can answer it in one sentence or a few sentences or whatever. But and this is going to totally sound out of left field. But Dan, why stay? Like, you know, your wife's out. You're clearly not an orthodox, literalistic believer in at least some senses. It's probably a little bit confusing. What keeps you in?
Gosh, you know, believe it or not, there's days I ask that myself. I think what... It's a complex answer, but I'll try to keep it short. You know, the Mormon Church is part of my family. And I don't have the pioneer ancestry that a lot of people do, that Laurie does. But it's kind of been there as part of my whole life. And when I look back at, you know, at my life's history with it, you know, I don't see a lot of negative that's come to me from it. I do see a lot of positive. A lot of the positive influences that it's had on me and a lot of the a lot of the people that have meant a lot to me who have been involved in it. And I guess I continue to have this, I guess, romanticized notion that I can draw the good from that. And maybe not hold all these orthodox beliefs, but take the good from that and continue to kind of, you know, I'm kind of on a journey too. But I can take a part of that. I can continue to try to get the good, draw the good in that from my family. You know, there's a lot of things I like about it. And as I look around, you know, as an adult, you know, I'm out of the youth program. You know, so it's different when you're an adult. But I look around at the people that I associate with there, you know, they're these great, wonderful people. So many of them, and I've gotten to know them well. And they're not people that I would know without that association. You know, because we're not in Utah, so it's not like my next door neighbors are my ward members. You know, I wouldn't really know any of these people.
Right.
And because I'm a, you know, I make my living, I commute into the, you know, in the San Francisco every day. I work as a journalist. There's not a lot of Mormons in that business, I'll tell you that. There's, you know, I wouldn't have this opportunity to associate with these folks that I think are just really wonderful people that are really committed to, you know, being good parents. The guys that I know in my elders quorum, they're really committed to being good fathers. And yeah, I can focus on the stuff that I think it's a good exercise for me too, because I can sit there and focus on what I have different, you know, that maybe I'm not as literalistic in my beliefs. Maybe I have more liberal political beliefs, and it's annoying to be assumed occasionally when people make a comment that all Mormons have to be conservative, and that's annoying, and this Prop 8 nonsense. And, you know, I could focus on the things that I have different and find things that are different. But when I focus on the things that draw me to them, that we have in common, the things we're trying to do in common, I feel this kinship and this strength, and I feel that I still benefit from my associations. And I, so that helps keep me involved. And I also have this strange, still wonderful connection to church history a bit, because I like to read history in period, you know, all kinds of history, because I think we learn from it. We learn from, and the mistake that we make in the Mormon church is that, you know, because the Mormon church spends so much effort to kind of like only put out a kind of polished, sanitized view of its history, Mormons lose the ability to really learn from that history. History should be crazy. It should be full of flawed, you know, crazy people who did crazy things. Joseph Smith, you know, was, you know, a very remarkable person. He was crazy in a lot of ways, I think. Maybe that, I'm sorry, I hope that doesn't sound offensive to listeners, but, you know, I continue to be fascinated learning his story. He's made some colossal mistakes. He did some good things. He brought some great ideas to the world. He made some huge blunders, and I still feel this connection to this, and I just wish that we were able to have a more broad discussion within the church about how we can learn from this, you know.
Right.
And maybe we'll get there at some point. I don't know. Maybe it won't be in my lifetime. I don't really know, but you know, it's something that I still feel a connection with, that even if I didn't attend anymore, you know, my ward on a weekly basis, I would still kind of have this connection to that history, to the story.
Sure.
You know, and it's a part of who I am, you know.
Yeah. All right, Laurie, I was going to ask this, but I feel impressed to ask you a similar question. Why rock the boat? Why leave?
I think that I don't think we rock the boat. I think it's rocking and we're hanging on for the ride. I mean, when people leave, it's a feeling of being compelled. It's a feeling of looking for more. Truthfully, we're all looking for happiness. That's all we're looking for. And some of us need to look outside of our given paradigm. I don't think that there is a choice to what you believe. And you certainly can't control that. It's this journey of digging deep and being willing to look at difficult things. It's a great way. If you can move through that fear, it's going to bring you to a huge sense of liberation, of peace and liberation. So if we can both come to that through our own way and land in a peaceful place, then we're doing all right.
Right. Do you really believe that your marriage is stronger and deeper now than it's ever been?
Oh, yeah.
I don't think that I really knew how to love before. I thought that he was an extension of me, right? We thought the same things and we believed the same things. But that's not love. that's really self-centeredness. And expecting someone to be like you, it's really just kind of loving you.
Loving yourself.
Yes.
Right, right.
So to start to really understand who he is and to not try and control him or tell him what he should or shouldn't do, and to actually recognize that Mormonism is a path for a lot of people. That's a great path. That's been really freeing for me as well. I guess I'm just really grateful that we went through this and that we were able to move past that fear, because now our lives, I don't think either one of us live in a state of fear anymore. And I didn't realize before, when I was in the Mormon belief system, how much fear I lived by from day to day, and just working so hard to make it to the end when someday I might be happy. So I would say to those who are faithful, to those who are leaving, to just keep looking for the things that leave you feeling peaceful and connected, that you can be happy right now. You can be happy today. And, you know, I'll quote the Beatles, because they say, you know, all you need is love. All you need is love. Mm.
And Dan, do you feel like you're more spiritual now, or there's a depthness and a richness to your spirituality, even though it's not maybe perfectly traditional? Or do you feel just less spiritual, like the spirit's left you and you're sort of dwelling with a half portion?
No, I don't. What changed in me is that I don't feel the need to have what I think is spiritual as solely defined by the LDS model of it. I don't think it has to be that way. And I don't think that you have to lose your testimony, whatever your testimony is of LDS theology, to be able to own your own spirituality and say, hey, there's some things that are just mine. That maybe don't line up. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm not a spiritual person by nature. I'm just not. And I spent a lot of my life in the LDS Church kind of feeling deficient because I wasn't. Whereas, you know, now I've gotten to a point where I'm comfortable with who I am by nature. But I also feel like, you know, I have to have this responsibility to own what I do believe more fully than I did. I can't go on autopilot resting on the fact that, you know, I'll ride my wife's coattails through the Mormon system because I don't have that option anymore. I have to own what I believe. I have to know it. I have to be able to, show it and articulate it and not laden it with extra baggage that's not core to what's important to me. So yeah, I do feel like, you know, a more spiritual person. I feel like I've taken, you know, this whole experience has forced me to, take more control of that and more control of what my belief is and more accountability rather than, you know, one quick story. When we were at BYU, I spent some time in the BYU library because I was always been troubled by the blacks in the priesthood question. And to make a long story short, after doing some research, I came to the conclusion even early on as a believer that it was basically a racist decision back by Brigham Young. And, you know, it didn't force me to like lose my testimony of that, but I did kind of stuff it because I thought, you know, I don't know how that works in a marriage, you know, and I'm in this Mormon marriage and I didn't want to like try to unravel all that. So it was just kind of like, it was kind of there. And I'm kind of at the point where it's like, you know, I can be responsible for what I believe and what I don't believe and be okay with it. But it has to be mine, you know. It can't be, you know, it can't be me relying on her being a more spiritual person to drive our family. I have to be a part of it. you know, I have to step up to the plate.
Right, right. Very good. Okay. Well, this has been absolutely fabulous. I'm just so grateful. Your stories are inspirational. I think you're going to provide a model to many, many people. I mean, this ain't going away. Alternative forms of spirituality aren't going away. People leaving the church over church history is only accelerating. I mean, that's just reality. And so, you know, it's sort of either, you know, divorces are going to be rampant, or everyone's going to be leaving the church, or people are going to figure out a way to deal in mixed faith marriages. And I want to believe that there's a place in the world for religion, and that there's a way that a mixed faith couple can make it work. And I think you guys provide a wonderful model for that. So I just want to thank you. I want to leave. I hope you guys remember that I was going to ask you this, but I guess I'm going to put you on the spot, Laurie, because I'm going to ask you to bring us home, and I'll ask Dan the same question in a salvific way, but I want you to provide just some summative pieces of advice for the disbelieving spouse in how they can manage and navigate their disaffection in a way that is optimally healthy for both the marriage and for the children and for themselves. So, you know, give us 5-10 highlight points that you would just want to leave us with. And then, Dan, I'm going to ask you to do the same thing for the believing spouse.
Oh, no pressure. it's so personal that everybody's story is so unique. So I can only share what worked for us. And that is that as the world drops out underneath you as far as wondering where you are in the church and how to move forward when your spouse doesn't want to move with you, is to just move slowly to try to see it from their perspective. And to decide what's really important to you. What do you need? Is it really important for you to change your lifestyle and experiment with things? And if so, how do you do that in a way that doesn't threaten your believing partner? Or is it more important that you are given the respect and freedom to speak to your children about your belief system and to teach them the problematic things of the church? Those are different things, and you can't throw them all at your spouse at once. So moving thoughtfully and carefully and gently through the process. The other thing is to ask for space, ask for support, ask for respect, and you give that.
Right.
And I think a huge portion for me was that I found it imperative to stop worrying about what he should or shouldn't be doing, to stop judging him or worrying about him, and to start looking at myself. I'm looking at myself and my behavior and my belief system has been the biggest thing that's brought me peace, being willing to look at that and move through being afraid of what's underneath there. And with the kids, it's really important not to put them in the middle of it, to keep those discussions with your spouse in the background so that when you come forward with the kids, it's on a united front, that you're clear about what you need and want. And I think it's super important for the non-believing spouse. It's really important for them to be able to speak honestly with their children. So I would say to any believing spouse who says, I'm going to raise my kids and I want them to go on missions and you may not teach them these problematic things, that is absolutely unacceptable. You can't force belief. And yours, both partners, both spouses, both parents need that freedom. They need that to have a honest, healthy relationship with their kids. So I would encourage that kind of space, allowing people, everybody in the family, the kids, the mom, the dad, everybody, the space to pursue their own spiritual relationship, whatever they deem as divine or the lack thereof, and and to be respectful to each other.
Wonderful. Thank you. All right, Dan, you're last.
Okay. So I'm for believers, right?
Yeah, but specifically, how can they show empathy and love and support and do it in a way that's good for everybody involved?
Sure. Well, like Laurie said, I think go for both directions. Respect is key. Getting to a place where you can respect each other and respect why you're in those positions, you can get to without being untrue to your respective beliefs. We found that in our case. I think that's very important. I think what you need to do, what's really important is that is to give up fear, because if your LDS theology, your personal theology, is based on you're doing stuff because you're afraid of what will happen if you don't do it, in the long term, that's not going to work well for your life, whether it's for your personal life, your marriage, for your children. Fear doesn't inspire. It's not inspiring. It's a burnout. And so if that's the core of your LDS beliefs, I would ask to rethink them. You don't have to drop them, but to rethink, is that really what Jesus was on this earth teaching? Is that the main idea he wanted? I don't think it is. And I think there's great things that you can believe, and your belief will be inspiring to your children. And even to your, and I think it'll be even inspiring to a spouse who doesn't believe anymore if it's not based on fear. If people can look at you and see the benefits, the positive benefits that come to your life through your belief, and you show that through your actions, through your positive, your positive relationship with the world, I think that's the best thing you can do, and that will be, and people will sense that. And you can't control people. You can't control other people's beliefs. You can't even control your kids' beliefs. Your kids will grow up. They've got minds of their own. I learned that from day one, that you can't have that control. So let go of the fear of what you think you can control, but you really can't. And try to embrace what's good and what brings positive benefits to your life by your belief. And realize that that the whole message of the gospel is about love, is about bringing people together. And these things can work. These things can work. And the eternal question, I think, still works. That's been my practice. That's been my experience. And both sides need to bring a state of love and not a state of fear to the conversation. I think when you get to those points, you can make some progress.
Outstanding. Well, I can't thank you guys enough for sharing with all of us your story. I think it's going to help not just this generation, but generations to come. Does that sound too bold?
Yes. You know, we're just two people with a story. There's hundreds of people out there. And I guess it's just nice to feel like we're not alone, that there's more people going through this and finding their own solutions to it. Ultimately, in the marriage, I think you just have to give them a reason to respect you.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you guys so much. I probably should give a shout out to Faces East. I'm pretty sure it's faceseast.org. It is. And it's basically dedicated to marriages, mixed faith marriages within the LDS Church. That's a great resource for people who are struggling. There's another resource called stayLDS.com, which can help people navigate this middle road. And for those of you who are interested, I've started a little forum on Mormon stories for those who are looking to work through these types of issues in privacy with others who are in a similar boat. So Just Facebook me so that I know you're real, and I'll give you information on how to join the forum. But I just want to for those of you who are near Salt Lake in August, I just wanted to let you guys know that I am holding, a workshop at Sunstone Symposium. It's August 4th. On August 4th, Wednesday, August 4th, I'll be holding a full-day workshop. The first half is navigating a crisis of faith in or out of the church, sort of tips and tricks. And then the afternoon is going to be for couples, and it's going to be navigating a marriage when one or both of you loses their testimony. So if any of you are interested, please let me know, or be looking at the SunstoneMagazine.com website for more details about that if you're interested. But Dan and Lori Gallagher, thank you so much for coming on Mormon Stories. You guys are wonderful people.
Thanks, John.
Thanks for having us, John.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.